God Made the Country and Man Made the Town, William Cowper. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate you listening. If you are a newcomer, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, thank you as well. I appreciate all your support. Sedentary life, and how this will, along with other factors, see the establishment of cities and then, of course, of civilizations. Excuse me. Now, before we get into this, I just want to do the whole standard prefacing thing. Of course, this process is not uniform. There are cultural variations that play a part in these types of moments, and there are differences that constitutes a town. So, of course, this process takes place at different times and different places. What is a city, and how do we define it? And has it always been considered the same thing? Now, the Encyclopedia Britannica defines a city as a, quote, relatively permanently and highly organized center of population, of greater size or importance than a village or town. The name city is given to certain urban communities by virtue of some legal or conventional distinctions that can vary between regions or nations. Now, the United Nations Human Settlements Program says that of the 233 countries that report data on urban areas, 104 consider a location urban based on a single set of criteria. And these include population size, population density, if they serve an administrative function, and even a handful of countries, they just list a place as a city, as a place that builds city-like infrastructure or buildings, I guess a vibes-based city, for lack of a better term. So what that means is, to most modern societies, cities are not really debated if they're a city or not. If they fall into these rules, laws, conventions, processes used to establish cities in their countries, then they are, by definition, a city. And so its residents are citizens of said city. So, historically, though, of course, there were no higher political bodies or authorities to dictate that sort of thing. So, a city, despite being a very real place filled with very real people, was much more ephemeral, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. Now, there have been plenty of political tracts and treatises on cities. And this means, what is a good city, what makes a city bad. This can include also what is the ideal city. But as far as I have been able to find from reading, the first person to lay out like a checklist of points that make a city was Vere Gordon Child. Now, I believe I've mentioned him before, at least I hope I did, when we talked about the term Neolithic and Neolithic Revolution. Child was a Marxist, so he was appropriately obsessed with revolutions. But this term involved 10 points that laid out a greater, or excuse me, laid out a kind of general framework on how cities formed and what these first cities looked like. And this was first laid out in his book, Man Makes Himself. That was published, I believe, in 1936. Child was a Australian by birth, but he worked, I believe, in from the 1920s until the 50s when he died. Now, this term involved 10 points or factors that kind of led to his general framework on how cities formed, or at least his idea of how cities formed. Now, some of his ideas are a product of his politics, and some are a product of artifacts that had been found up to that point. Now, obviously, with what we know today, he might not 100% still use these factors. He might come up with some others, but we do not know for sure. But he does have some decent criteria, I think, that needs to be taken into account, and it still is taken into account. And even his critics of this model of urbanization at they acknowledge that he has some, you know, decent points, or he is in general, you know, in the right direction. His ideas aren't completely wrong, though some of his points, some argue, are completely wrong. And I think there are a couple that he gets wrong as well. But again, part of that is just he's working on what he knew at the time. And the point of this episode, or the primary point of this episode, is that we will be going and diving into these points and talking about them. So let's start with his first point. First would be that size and density of the population should be above normal. Now, I don't find anyone who disagrees with this in principle, though, of course, what is normal differs based on place and, of course, time. But again, no one really disputes that. In fact, that's generally one of the things with cities is that they are big. Second point is that the urban population has developed a number of specialized roles or jobs not related to food production. This part of the definition would eliminate a number of sites that we discussed last season. Chattahoochee, Jericho. And this is one I don't know that I agree with, or at least I think that it's one of the less important criteria, if that makes sense. Now, I don't deny that cities see a wider range of careers and job, you know, opportunities. But I think it's conceivable that a site could hit the population and density requirement well before any specialized roles are needed. Essentially that these specialized roles are not a cause of cities, but more that they are a symptom of cities. And we'll see that there are specialized roles that don't have anything to do with food production in none state societies, or at least more mobile, less urban societies. And in fact, I think it could be argued that there are places where these specialized jobs emerge before urban centers emerge, and that they may have emerged while the time the first cities were being founded in the periphery, in areas in Europe's perspective. As an example. So I think this is one of the ones that if he's not wrong about, he's putting too much emphasis on. Third, this is the payment of taxes to a city's ruler, king, deity, governing body, what have you. Now, this absolutely happened, but taxes and tributes were paid in other non-hunter-gatherer societies. And this is probably more of a product of any kind of state than than just cities. Though I think, to be fair to him, it's probably very likely that this happened in cities first as opposed to these other places. Fourth, this includes monumental public buildings. I think that this has pretty definitively been disproven. There have been plenty of stateless and non-urban societies that build monumental structures. Göbekli Tepe, for instance. Stonehenge is another example. Now, you could argue that those buildings in cities served a governmental or administrative role. And that these monuments from other societies or non-urban societies did not serve that purpose. However, it is important to remember that while we may not know exactly why they were used or built, there's no evidence to suggest that they weren't an important part or even an organizing part of those societies that could have been part of their way to keep their societies and, you know, groups together. That they could have been a uniting force. They may not have had a day-to-day role, but they still served a vital and important role in these societies' makeup and history and practices. So I think they should be considered the same. So this is a point I think Child is completely wrong on, and I think there are people who agree with me on that. In fact, I know there are. Number five, there are people in cities not producing their own food that are supported by your temple, your government, your king, etc. It's important to note, however, this is certainly true, but again, there are examples of this in non-urban societies. And it's also important to realize that people producing food were also being supported by these governmental institutions. They did not just distribute food to people who did not produce food. They distributed it to food producers too. They would kind of collect everything and then divvy things out as needed. We'll talk about it later, but, you know, the redistribution of food or the storage of food, keeping these surpluses safe for times of need, was one of the primary reasons that these organizations developed. So this isn't just a, you know, case of, you know, and to use Marxist terms, you know, the upper class living off the work and labor of the proletariat. That's not what this was. But I can see why, you know, Child would, you know, include that, especially at his time. The sixth point, and this kind of overlaps a little bit with the seventh point. In fact, on some lists I read, they're swapped. But there is the development of record keeping / writing and development of practical sciences. Now, I think in general this is a decent enough point, though I would maybe make some small challenges, at least to the definitions. Practical science might better be called formalized science. There are plenty of societies that develop innovations without like a formal schooling or, you know, like a formal school or an academy or, you know, a place where people are trained like in large numbers. This could be something done at a small scale and eventually expands because it is such a good invention. Now, when it comes to writing, writing generally does come from settled urban societies. Now, why writing develops isn't always record based, but in most cases it has been, at least as far as we've been able to determine. And writing is one of those truly revolutionary ideas and systems. And we'll get into that a little bit later once writing develops and it expands out, but that won't be too much of this season. We'll probably talk about that some during this season, because I think there are proto-writings, but it's not true written language. Now, this leads us to point eight, the development of symbolic art. This cannot be tied to urban societies. There's other symbolic art. In fact, I think you'd easily argue that symbolic art very much predates urban societies. Now, he was more of the opinion, I think, that it was symbolic art incorporated into things like pottery and day-to-day artifacts. But again, I don't think that this can be firmly classified as urban. This is one I would vehemently disagree on. Now, certainly there are, you know, less urbanized societies that maybe have less symbolic art, but I think that's more of a factor of, resources. People who don't have as many resources find it harder to have the time, generally speaking, to develop more symbolic art. But that's not to say they don't have any, and that's not to say they didn't produce any. So again, I don't think that this 8 point stands up in any long-term scrutiny. Yeah, so again, this is more of a human phenomenon than a urban phenomenon, in my opinion. And again, I think it's one that most people, or at least a good number of people, would share. His ninth point is long distance trade and importation of raw materials or resources. Now this, I don't think in and of itself it's long distance trade and import. What I would classify as urban is large scale long distance trade and import. And at that point I would agree with him. But of course, humans have been trading, at least on some level, since they were, you know, barely more than just small hunter-gatherer groups. But in this case, I would say that this is more of an urban product than a hunter-gatherer human product. And of course, again, trade happens, but it's not nearly to the scale of urban societies. So in this case, if you include the description that it is large scale, yes, I would agree with this point. Though again, not fully. I think he may have wanted to include, especially being a Marxist, I'm surprised he didn't include this, but large-scale trade in luxury goods as opposed to merely practical material, but that may be just me projecting onto his politics. 10, the final point, is that membership of a society, or in this case a city, is based solely on your residence rather than any kin, group, or relation. Like a blood relationship. It's solely based on if you live in the city, you are part of the city. Now this one, I think, is probably correct, at least as far as the government of a city was concerned. If you lived in the confines of the city, you were probably obligated at some level. And of course, some people were more obligated than others to contribute something to the city as a whole. But as we'll talk about, and as we will see, not everyone was accorded the same protections or levels of membership as everyone else. There are what we would call citizenship was not universal, even to people who were residents and who contributed to cities. And I'm not just referring to slaves here. I am talking about other other peoples as well. And this is something I think Child would probably agree with, but also there is not an example of, or I should say there are also examples of people living and working as free people in non-urban societies as well, who are maybe in some cases even more integrated into those societies than they were integrated into urban societies. So I think Child has a very, a very good, very nuanced idea, and I appreciate what he was trying to do. And again, some of his stuff is just he did not have access to the same level of knowledge and discoveries that we have today. Göbekli Tepe, for instance. Çatalhöyük, for instance. So I think with what he knew at the time, he did have some good, reasonable assumptions. So personally, I would definitely think, of course, the population density and numbers being above the average, I think that's a great starting point. I think number one is right on the money in terms of starting a definition of what's a city. I think also, though, we need to take into account that it's a scale issue, in my opinion. I think a city has it's a large scale entity. And I don't mean that just in terms of numbers. I mean in terms of pretty much everything. We're talking about people. We're talking about output. I don't think a distinction needs to be made between food and non-food production. I think it's just a matter of production as a whole should determine what is a city and what isn't. If you were to tell me if I had to choose between which of these locations is a city and which of these is not, and the choice was a city or a place like Çatalhöyük that had at most, like at its high point, around 10,000 people, and they were all focused on producing mostly food, versus a city or a location of 1,000 people, where 200 were producing food, 100 were producing leather or clothing, and then, another 100 were producing metal or jewelry, and then you had a small number of, administrators, for lack of a better term, and then, just a few random people, and you had to choose which one was a city and which one wasn't, I would probably lean towards the larger place. At least that would be my opinion. Because the fact of the matter is, we don't know how those large agricultural places like Çatalhöyük and Göbekli Tepe were organized. I doubt that, of course, they had a single leader, but I do think that they had some type of organization. Now, those people, upon death, may not have received any type of, they may have not have stood out in terms of burial or anything like that. They may not have had additional grave goods, because again, with cities, you do begin to see a kind of social stratification, at least when it comes to burial and goods like that, between the sexes, that kind of thing. That may not show up clearly in the archaeological records of these other places, but I don't think that necessarily dictates that the place wasn't a true quote-unquote city. So, again, I think Child was coming from a good place, but I think some of his assumptions in the end haven't panned out, and I hope as we go forward, you'll kind of see what I'm talking about and then make it a little bit clearer. So, it's a good starting point, but I don't think his explanation is ultimately valid. So yeah. Before we go any further in talking about cities, though, I think maybe we should talk about other types of sedentary places that you know, cities evolved from, and in some places people never evolved out of them. Of course, those being like the village, hamlet, or town. All of which nowadays, or at least until recently, were official designations for, you know, permanent settlements in the past. But at least in the case of village or hamlet, they can be used interchangeably in common usage, at least. And let's do some etymology talking about these types of places. First, let's start with hamlet, which was the Old English, I think was the, or not Old English, but in England was the smallest official designation for an officially recognized settlement. Now, hamlet entered into English from the Frankish heim, that, or it was some other Germanic source, possibly from Proto-Germanic heimas, which meant home. And this is from probably from a Proto-Indo-European root, something like kai, and that's meant to settle, to dwell, something like that. And that combined with the ending let, tekailet, or lai. I'm not sure how that would be pronounced. I'm not sure if the T would be silent in that sense. But official hamlets typically lack any kind of local government or religious institution. This is generally, people are in hamlets are generally related to each other in some way. Not necessarily brothers and sisters, but possibly, you know, third or fourth cousins. And this isn't going to be a huge number of people. I think officially, hamlets don't surpass 100 in terms of population. And even then, that's a very large hamlet. That's probably out of the ordinary. Generally speaking, you're probably talking between 30 and 50 individuals. So, you know, in comparison to hunter-gatherer bands, which are usually no more than, you know, 10 or so, 20 at the most, with the exception, of course, the seasonal meetings we talked about, or annual meetings, excuse me, where their numbers could jump up to like 150. A hamlet is pretty much going to be no more than 100 all the time, year round. I guess in a comparison between a sedentary and a non-sedentary society, a hamlet would essentially be the bands of sedentary societies or sedentary sites, which again, bands are the smallest form of hunter-gatherer societies outside of course, individual families, which for that, it'd be something like a homestead, I guess, for sedentary groups. Now, next up in the kind of official hierarchy, at least in England, and in other places, but you'd have something that would be like a village. Now, the population of villages, of course, can vary, but usually no more than a couple of hundred. I think once you get to around 500, though, you're probably reaching a town in terms of what most people would call that. And then, you know, again, hunter-gatherer societies, 150 is probably the maximum number that you would have for a number of bands, all the interrelated, which would typically be what would probably be called a tribe at that point. So, yeah, I guess village and tribe are kind of the equivalent of each other in most situations. Now, village entered English probably after the Norman conquest, and it came from the old French village, which is houses or other buildings in a group. And this came from Latin, villaticum, which meant, which was a farmstead with extra buildings added on, essentially. It's grown more than a farm. And of course, this evolved from villa, which was a country house. And this probably came from a Proto-Indo-European root word, wyk, which meant clan, which should offer a little bit of a hint. These type of settlements probably evolved out of seasonal meeting places where a number of smaller hunter-gatherer bands gathered every so often. Now, I don't mean to say that their villages grew up where they were meeting. I mean to say that that's kind of the equivalent of what they were. There are probably a number of, you know, hamlets that were fairly close by, and they maybe decided to centralize for resources or maybe defense. In a lot of early villages, you'll see a lot of very rudimentary defenses built. Wooden palisades, walls, earthen walls, small ones, ramps maybe, and possibly even a couple of towers, like small watchtowers for overlooking. Though it's possible and probably more likely that these walls did not serve necessarily purely defensive functions. They were probably also used to help corral animals and just make sure that they didn't run off in the nights, or, you know, to give them a, you know, easy place to kind of store them, maybe while people were away and they couldn't afford to have them out in the fields, grazing for too long. Then we have the town. Now, town comes from the Old English tún, which meant like, it could mean a number of things. It could mean like enclosed field or farm. It could have meant manor or homestead. And this came from the Proto-Germanic tunas or tunan. This came from the Proto-Indo-European duno, which meant an enclosed fortified place. And then that itself was probably from a Proto-Indo-European root word that was something like a dehu or deo, which was like to close or to finish. A number of different Proto-Indo-European languages, Celtic used dunon, the Welsh used den, the Irish used dun, and all of these were some type of fortified settlement, walled, strong settlements. And that's generally what you see in a lot of the European steppe and in, you know, further into Europe before cities arose. There are a very large number of different fortified, essentially towns. And these, you know, they weren't necessarily huge. Some could have been as small as, you know, 300, 400, 500 range. And then there were some that were probably a little bit larger than that. But all of them, generally speaking, had smaller settlements on their kind of outskirts. In the places like the Middle East, you know, these places were also fairly widespread. Though whether or not, you know, they were fortified or not, that kind of depended on other factors. Wood being hard to come by and stone, generally earthen ramparts were more important in those type of places, or rammed earth structures. Not that that necessarily has anything to do with the etymology. And we'll talk about the etymology for those places next week. But I did want to just go ahead and mention again, I know that these are the English terms for these type of settlements. And the English definition is not necessarily the correct one. The sizing is not necessarily right. But that's just kind of a general, just trying to give people a general idea of what we're referring to. Of course, other places, again, size difference, function difference will matter a little. So just keep that in mind. I know that there are other places that have very similar definitions to England, and not all of them are places that were colonized by the English or the British. I think Switzerland has a very similar kind of convention. But yeah, like in America, we don't have hamlets, though people will occasionally use that to talk about really small towns. It's not an official designation. Next week we'll talk about how the first cities in the Middle East evolved from a number of towns, essentially, again, for lack of a better definition, kind of merged together and formed together, and what their organizing principles were. And then I'll try to go over maybe a couple of other regional variations, though maybe there might not be very good examples this season. I'll have to double check my timeline, but a true city, at least what we will talk about in terms of, again, my definition of just scale, in terms of just large size. And large outputs. Again, I don't know that we'll get to any outside of the Middle East this season. Maybe one or two in China, possibly one or two in Egyptian part of Africa. But we'll talk about it next week. I also plan to go a little bit more into some other philosophical stuff, and we'll talk about what a city is, and a couple of other definitions. But this was just kind of a breakdown of more practical aspects of cities. Next week we'll go a little bit more into maybe political / religious aspects of cities. I hope you're looking forward to it. I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. Thank you all for listening. You can send me any feedback you'd like at war@revpod.gmail.com. You can direct message me on Twitter. Rest of your day and a good rest of your week. See you next time. Goodbye.